The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening. Sometimes when people talk about their Dharma practice, they use language that implies that the Dharma is somehow distinct from other parts of life. So, for example, at the end of retreat, people often say, so when I go back to regular life, or if they're talking about their cushion practice, they might say, in the rest of life, such and such is like that, but here on the cushion, it's different, or in my normal life, such and such. So all of these ways of speaking maybe indicate that somewhere in our mind, we have the idea that the Dharma is different from the rest of life, or that practice is somehow distinct from the rest of life. So this, maybe even without realizing it, we've made a little distinction like that. So I'm calling this talk the Dharma Life, and I want to talk a little bit about our interface between what we think of as our life and the Dharma and practice, and how we can live in a way that is where those are somewhat connected. And it may be that that's not an issue in your life or not interesting, and that's fine. Or it might be that that is interesting, but you're not sure how to do that. Or it might be that you're trying really, really hard to connect everything together. And almost the harder you try, the less it works. So it's all fine. I think there will be something for everyone. When I went to practice in Sri Lanka a few years ago, the monk that I was practicing with was named Dhammajiva, which means Dharma life. And I think it suited him. And he really had taken things in. So in this book, the First Free Women, it's a kind of an interpretation of the Terigata, the poems of the awakened nuns. There's this verse, which I also read during the meditation. This is from the nun Sakula. If there is something in these teachings calling out to you, it's because something in you is calling out to these teachings. The path will take you whenever you're ready, just as you are. So I want to talk a bit about this. That last phrase, just as you are, is so important in practice. Such an important idea. And the context is that the path will take us when we're ready, whenever we're ready, just as we are. So it's not really that we need to be different, but we do need to be ready. And that has to do somehow with our relationship to the teachings and our relationship to practice. So what is this being ready? It seems to be kind of a balance or a middle way among a number of different relationships that we might have to practice. And it's something that we explore in ourselves over time. But one relationship that I want to start with, because it's such a common one, is to see our practice as the ultimate self-improvement project. And, you know, so we use various reflection or self-assessment tools, and we come up with an idea or a list almost of what our issues or our difficulties are. And then we come up with some strategies for addressing those. And I'm making it very explicit. I don't know if not everyone does it so explicitly, but we can check, you know, maybe even subtly in our mind, we have this idea. So for example, we might decide that we have an issue with anger. And so we're going to try anger management workshops. And We're going to do nonviolent communication so that we can connect better with people that we find irritating. And we're going to do psychotherapy in order to work out the issues of our upbringing. And then we're going to do meditation for calming the mind and opening the heart. So we have subtly in our mind kind of this list of things that we're going to address through various practices. So let me say, first of all, that all of those things are great things to do. They're very valuable and they do reduce suffering. So I recommend those. However, what I'm pointing to here is that kind of background idea going on, where we have an idea of what the issues are that we know this is it, and we're going to work on that by doing various things. So there's kind of a plan. Is a sort of a rational plan. And the subtle conclusion is that when I've really processed all of these things that I'm working on, then I will be well on my way to awakening. And that's what it's going to take. And maybe a subtler underlying attitude there is the idea that awakening means that all of my rough spots are going to be smoothed out and all of my oddities are going to go away. And I'm going to become that ideal person that I imagine I can be. So I'm being pretty kind of direct, and not because this is a completely wrong approach, but just because we have to be aware if we have that attitude. I'll give you now an example of something that happened for someone I know in practice, which is that they began just following the meditation instructions, you know, follow the breath. When the mind wanders away, let go of that and return to the breath. Really stay connected to the body sensations and the breath in the present moment. And they did that pretty diligently for a number of months, I think it was. And then they noticed, to their surprise, that they were less angry at work. And this was a little bit shocking to them, because they thought, well, wait a minute, if anger is going to be reduced, shouldn't I have had to work directly on the anger? And I should have done metta practice. But suddenly it's just like there's just less reactivity, less being prone to anger. So it was surprising, because all they'd been doing was trying to follow their breath for some period of time per day. But the path sometimes works like this. Well, sometimes we work directly with things, but sometimes we don't have to work directly on things for them to fall away. The path works a little bit sometimes in unseen ways and sometimes in surprising ways. And so it's important to be open to that, and not to feel that everything has to be managed directly by working on that exact thing. Who knows? I mean, we might in some ways reinforce difficulties by working on them directly. You know, if we make the more we see, oh, I'm an angry person, I've got to work on this anger, I have this problem with anger or sadness or depression, we almost reify it in a certain way. So there's a little bit of subtlety there in knowing that our mind has certain tendencies, but not making them into a self, not identifying them with how we are. So sometimes it's best just to return to the breath and be surprised where that can take us. It's not that we don't ever work on things, but sometimes that can also bring up, say, an attitude of aversion. You know, we can decide, if we've decided that this is the good part of my mind and this is the bad part of my mind, and I have to work on the bad part and make it go away, then only the good will be left. That's a particular attitude about practice. And so we don't want to be cultivating that sense of aversion to part of our mind. So I would say this is a way, if we've made this big division between good and evil in the mind, that's a way that we might not be quite ready for the path to come and take us, referring back to the quote. But as our awareness gets more steady, and you know, by just cultivating mindfulness in daily life and regular sitting practice, there's a way in which we're less likely to get overwhelmed by thoughts and emotions, then we can start maybe practicing with the idea that certain things will untangle themselves if we're just give them some space and see them clearly. So we're certainly not going to deny that there are various difficulties in the mind coming up, but there is a sort of an attitude we can have where if I see this, there's some part of it that can disentangle itself. And then maybe when I've seen it more clearly and let that part go, maybe there's some direct work to do also. But having that awareness that some of it can work itself out is so important on the path and creates so much more spaciousness for us. It's kind of how the Dharma works. We get more in tune with the Dharma being able to do that for us. So if your tendency is to sort of actively work on parts of the mind, you might consider this somewhat simpler approach, either just dropping things and returning to the breath again and again without judgment, or even holding something in a space of awareness that's strong enough to hold it and kind of letting itself play itself out. It can be really a helpful approach. Now, there is, of course, a structure to the path. It's not that it's all just open and there's no... Of course, the Buddha had many, many teachings. In particular, he taught the Eightfold Path. So we do get a series of steps that are worth learning, knowing that the path is going to include these eight things of our view, our intention, our speech, our action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. All of those factors will be developed as we proceed along the path, as we transform the mind in the way that it can through practice. So I do encourage learning this structure. I'm also a big fan of asking people to read the suttas, and the original discourses of the Buddha, as part of the practice in order to understand the main principles that he was teaching. But this is pointing now toward another subtle attitude that I want to highlight on the path, another way that we think we're kind of in control or managing our own path. And that is that we can get attached also to that structure. So there are also people who spend a lot of time reading Dharma books or even reading the suttas and learning all the principles and trying very hard to match their experience up to what they have heard or read. And this one is subtle because you do need to listen to the Dharma like we are today, and you do need to learn something about what the main points are that the Buddha was making about things that we need to cultivate and things that we'll be letting go along the path. And yet, we don't want to take that up as kind of an abstract theoretical model that we then impose onto our experience, because our experience just is what it is. And so if we're subtly applying these ideas to them, we are again, in a very subtle way, controlling it. If we have an idea, let's see, I'm supposed to look for which part of effort I'm working on right now. Let's see, which is it? You know, which of the four aspects of effort is relevant right now? In a way, while we're doing that, we're not fully taking in the experience of the moment. And we're subtly also seeing certain parts of experience and ignoring other parts that we don't think fit what our idea of the path is. Because until until we're awake, we can only have an idea of exactly what it is that we're doing. And so there's a way in which our theoretical ideas also act as barriers toward actually walking the path, actually engaging with experience and finding our freedom within it. So this is not at all to discourage study and that kind of thing any more than I am discouraging working on and understanding our difficulties. But just to know that there are attitudes around that can hinder the way that we are able to be free in experience. So the good news about the Eightfold Path is that it's very, the more I work with it, the more impressed I am that it has a way of undermining identifications, that by actually following the steps of the path as they're laid out, you know, here's what right view entails, here's what right intention entails, and aiming to do that in our own experience, everything will be undermined. It will undermine even itself. So in a way, the Eightfold Path is a process that undoes even identification with the path. It's quite beautiful. So there's this balance in watching the mind for its tendency to want to control and manipulate and theorize, and then also with this sense of being open and easeful and letting things unfold as they are. So the beginning of the verse from Sukula, remember, it goes like this. If there is something in these teachings calling out to you, it's because there's something in you calling out to these teachings. So this is another way of considering our relationship to the Dharma. So this is yet another means of connecting, of interfacing with our practice. So here you are right now listening to these teachings. Is there something in you that has drawn you here this morning? Is there something in you that is calling out to attend a sit and a Dharma talk? So maybe just taking a moment to feel what it is in you that brought you here today. And then equally so, can you hear something calling out to you? If there's something in these teachings that is calling out to you, so what is this resonance between the teachings and your heart? Is there some sense of resonance there? On a recent IRC retreat, Paul Haller was talking about the invitation of the far shore. That was the phrase he used, and it really caught my attention. So the far shore is a poetic term for the goal of Buddhist practice, which is the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's called the far shore. So it's not so much that is a different place, far removed from here, but it's more that we're often not focused on it. You know, what we're focused on is kind of all the stuff that's right in front of us and is occupying our attention. And that's collectively in Buddhism called the near shore. And then there's the far shore. So when the near shore is in focus, you know, when we're really focused on all of those things that keep us busy, we're not focused on the far shore. You know, it's in our far, far field vision in a sense. And so, but it does invite us. It does invite us, doesn't it? So even when we're here on the near shore and we're taking care of our lives, there's an invitation in each moment from the far shore. And that can help, in a way, take us deeper into ourselves, deeper into this moment, whatever it is. So discerning this call, whether we're discerning the invitation or the call from the far shore, or whether we're discerning what in our own heart is calling out toward that, we would need to listen. We need to listen in order to hear that. So I call this contemplation. The word contemplate can include kind of a sense of combining listening for this invitation and an internal contemplation of what is wanting to be offered or what is wanting to come forth from the heart. So in a way, we invite the Dharma. as well as the Dharma inviting us? And are we in tune with what that is for us right now? So relating to the teachings can get very intimate. It's something that we each have to discern for ourselves, and it will change, of course, all along our path. So it's maybe different at the beginning, and then farther along, and then even farther along, there's a way in which how we're relating to the teachings is coming forth differently in our heart. So there's maybe a beautiful phrase about that we could contemplate, which is the traditional refuge is in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And we might consider, is there a way in which we feel like the Buddha is in our own heart, right here? And is there a way in which we feel that the Dharma is something that is flowing through our veins? It's nourishing all the cells of the body. And is there a way in which the Sangha is not something outside that we're relating to, but that the Sangha can never be separated from us? It's sort of a part of us. The whole Sangha is contained just within this being. And considering in this way, it's as if refuge is woven into our very being. And this is something that we can point to maybe during meditation with the breath, the way the breath flows through the whole body, beats with the heart, and unifies everything that's in the body and the mind. Of course, it's not like this every time we sit, but it can be a sort of a guiding idea in our practice and finding the way in which that resonates for us and the way in which, you know, once we have done this enough, kind of saturated ourselves with this sense of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha being in the fiber of our being, then seeing what actions can come forth from that, you know, how we get up from the cushion and talk with people, and how we get up and do our work around the house or for our job. I would say that when we've done this enough, then that's what it means to be ready for the path to take us just as we are, you know, just as we are, but with the addition of the refuge woven into our being. So we can look, for example, at how longtime practitioners practice. What do they do? Mostly, they go along with their life, but every now and then, they undertake particular practices or trainings of some kind. So, you know, it might feel like it's time to do a retreat with a particular teacher or a self-retreat, or to take a trip to Asia, or to set aside a time for writing. These things have a way of feeling like they're ripe, and then we say, oh yeah, okay, this is time. Now it's time to do this next thing. It just feels like it's the time. And usually there is some fruit when it really feels like something is ripe and it's the time to do a short retreat or take a class on something. There will be some fruit from it, but sometimes it's surprising. That's one of the hallmarks of the Dharma, is that it's a surprise. And we know there's something coming, something there, but what it actually is not anything that we could have thought necessarily. So truly we're not in control of this process, but we can sense it as it flows along. That's this balance that we're finding. And it's really, in some ways, only a matter of how deeply we accept that we're not in control. And yet there is something happening. We have a role to play. So relax, in a sense, relax and allow the path to unfold. Sometimes it will do so easily, sometimes not so easily, but it's always going to be unfolding just how it can. And this is this is the life of the Dharma, the continual unfolding of that So let me read this verse one more time. If there's something in these teachings calling out to you, it's because something in you is calling out to these teachings. The path will take you whenever you're ready, just as you are. So you are great just as you are. In fact, you're probably on the path just by being here and sensing into your experience as it is. And I hope very much that you find this resonance as often as possible. Yeah, sometimes we fall out of it, but when we're in it, there's this sense of resonance between what's calling out from our heart and the call of the far shore, the teachings. So may your path progress very well, and be well. So if there are any questions or comments, we do have a couple of minutes, and I welcome anything coming into the chat. Please be aware that I have a delay, and so I won't see it right away. But if you wanted to ask any questions or make any comments, I'll see if there's anything else I can say, and otherwise, have a wonderful day or evening. I see a question about the book that I read from. It's called The First Free Women, Poems of the Early Buddhist Nuns. And it's not exactly a translation of the Terigata. It's, of course, based on that, but it's more of an interpretation. It's somewhat more poetic. I recommend it. All right. Thank you.